people in the Hare Krishna movement, and she's a teacher, sort of, I suppose, by trade, both teaching adults and teaching children, and teaching adults the Krishna consciousness, like all sort of older devotees do, and also teaching devotees and teaching people how to teach young people and teach young devotees in the school system. And that's really praiseworthy, because the future of any movement, and especially the most important movement from our perspective that exists, the Hare Krishna movement, it depends on the younger persons in our family to remain devotees as they get older, and not just remain, but become Krishna conscious examples and leaders. And without having a strong educational institution or educational foundation within our society, that's not really possible in the bigger scheme of things. So for this reason, I'm proud to know Irmala, and I see her as someone, you know, that we could aspire to be like, and certainly we have lots to learn from. She's been in the Hare Krishna movement since she was very, very young, and she came from a good family that I know of personally, well-known family, she gave everything to Krishna with her life, despite all sort of attractions to follow the path that practically everyone else does in this world. And she's based in North Carolina, and is that where you're hailing from now, Mataji?
I am now based in North Carolina for the foreseeable future. That was...
Okay. Well, fortunate for those in North Carolina. Okay, so let's get to the program. So we're going to have Irmala Mataji will give a class in the Bhagavad Gita. Everyone's basically been here before, so you know how it goes. So we have class till approximately 7 o'clock, but that includes questions and answers, which Irmala is free to choose to take at the end of the class or throughout, however she likes. And class can go, if she wants to end it a little earlier than that or a little after, that's fine, it's up to her. And then after the class we'll have a short Hare Krishna Kirtan of 5 minutes, and if it's getting too late for Irmala Mataji's schedule by then one of us, perhaps myself, will be volunteer to lead that. And if I might now ask you, Irmala, to chant Jai Radha Madhava before speaking, that'd be great.
Jaya Vishnupad Paramahamsa Parivrajakacharya Asatara Satashri Shimana Divine Vaisesi Bhaktivedanta Swami Maharaj Prabhupada Ki Jai. ISKCON founder Acharya Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Nantakoti Vaishnava Vrinda Ki Jai. Namacharya Srila Haridas Thakur Ki Jai. Prem Shikaho Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shri Vasadi Kaur Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai. Shri Shri Radha Krishna Gokopina Shai Mukunda Radha Kunda Kiri Govardhana Ki Jai. Vrindavan Dhamma Ki Jai. Mathura Dhamma Ki Jai. Navajit Mayapur Dhamma Ki Jai. Jagannath Puri Dhamma Ki Jai. Gangamayi Jamuna Devi Ki Jai. Bhakti Devi Ki Jai. Tulsi Maharani Ki Jai, Samaveda Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai, Gaur Premanande. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasaya Bhutale Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namane. Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Charani. Nirvasesa Sunyavadi Paskachade Satarni. Bandeham Sri Guru Sri Yuta Padakamalam Sri Guru Vaishnavamscha. Sri Rupam Sagra Jatam Sahagana Raganatham Vitam Stam Sajivam. Sadvaitam Sadvajitam Padichana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam. Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakam Vitamscha Panchakalpa Trupascha Kipasanaviya Vatapritanam Pavanevya Vaishnavya Namo Namah. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So, it's September 19th, 2020. We're reading from the Bhagavad Gita, Chapter 2, Contents of the Gita Summarized, Text 6, and this is in New York over the internet. Na chaitad vidma kataram nagariyo. Na chaitad vidma kataram nagariyo. Yadva jamena yarivano jayu. Yadva janema yarivano jayu. Yameva hatvana jivi visamyas. Yaneva hatvana jivi visamas. Tevastita pramuke dartarastraha. Tevastita pramuke dartarastraha. Na. Nor. Cha. Also. Etat, this, vidmaha, do we know, katarat, which, naha, for us, gariya, better, yatva, whether, jayema, we may conquer, yadi, if, va, or, naha, us, Jaya Yuhu, they conquer. Yan, those who. Eva, certainly. Hatva, by killing. Na, never. Jijiv Isa Maha, we would want to live. Te, all of them. Avastitaha, are situated, pramukhe, in the front, dhritarashtraha, the sons of Dhritarashtra, Srila Prabhupada's translation. Nor do we know which is better, conquering them or being conquered by them. If we killed the sons of Dhritarashtra, we should not care to live. Yet, they are now standing before us on the battlefield. Srila Prabhupada's purport. Arjuna did not know whether he should fight and risk unnecessary violence, although fighting is the duty of the Kshatriyas, or whether he should refrain and live by begging. If he did not conquer the enemy, begging would be his only means of sustenance. Nor was there a certainty of victory, because either side might emerge victorious. Even if victory awaited them and their cause was justified, still, if the sons of Dhritarashtra died in battle, it would be very difficult to live in their absence. Under the circumstances, that would be another kind of defeat for them. All these considerations by Arjuna definitely prove that not only was he a great devotee of the Lord, but he was also highly enlightened and had complete control over his mind and senses. His desire to live by begging, although he was born in the royal household, is another sign of detachment. He was truly virtuous, as these qualities, combined with his faith in the words of instructions of Sri Krishna, his spiritual master, indicate. It is concluded that Arjuna was quite fit for liberation. Unless the senses are controlled, there is no chance of elevation to the platform of knowledge. And without knowledge and devotion, there is no chance of liberation. Arjuna was competent in all these attributes, over and above his enormous attributes in the material relationships. Nachaitad vidma kataram nogariyo yadva jamena yadiva nojayayu yam eva hatva na jivi samas Te vastita pramukhe dhartarastraha. Nor do we know which is better, conquering them or being conquered by them. If we killed the sons of Dhritarashtra, we should not care to live, yet they are no standing before us on the battlefield. So we often have these kind of situations where we look at this situation, that situation, another situation, and they're all bad. We just say, well, if I do this, it's bad in this way. If I do this, it's bad in this way. If I do this, it's bad in this way. And I just don't know what to do. What do I do? All my choices are bad. I remember many years ago when I had resigned from running a gurukula so I could focus on writing curriculum. And I had intended for it to be a very gradual resignation. It didn't quite work out that way. And then I really didn't have the facility that I had intended. So I thought, all right, well, I need to move somewhere. And so I had a couple offers of places to move. But nothing looked very good. I mean, everything was looking quite difficult. And I finally did something I don't normally do. I consulted with an astrologer for what's called a prashna, where you ask a question. And I said, basically, should I go to A or B, and then C was where I was. And the astrologer said, they're all bad. He said, C would be the least bad, but they're all bad. And it was interesting. He said that all the promises you've been made and everything you expect would not happen. And with one of the places, one of the persons who'd invited me passed away in a car accident like 2 months later. And the other one, also there was some big upheaval. So it was quite interesting. But here I had three choices ahead of me, and, you know, they're all bad. So this is Arjuna's situation. He's got a bunch of choices in front of them, and they're all bad. And this is the sort of difficulty. We don't want to say a dilemma, because that means two. Here he has at least three choices, where we just go, ah, you know, I just don't know what to do. We sometimes call this between a rock and a hard place, right? Where you look at the pros and cons of everything, and you pretty much only see cons. Yeah, it's very important to note that this is the verse right before Arjuna changes his relationship with Krishna from one of equal friends and peers to that of guru and disciple. And it's interesting that Srila Prabhupada in this purport refers to Krishna as Arjuna's spiritual master, although really that relationship doesn't get established until after Arjuna says this. So Arjuna's like, I don't know what to do. I need some help, right? I'm lost. I don't have any good choices. I need some help. So I'm sure we're all familiar with the background of this particular question, but we'll take just a few minutes to look at the history of why Arjuna is asking this question. What's going on here that Arjuna is having this problem? So we had a situation where the king, Vichitravirya, died without having an heir. He had no children. And what was done in those days was the brother of the dead man could impregnate his brother's wives, and those would be considered legally as the children of the dead husband. So Vichitravirya had a half-brother, Vyasadev, and he produced children. Vichitravirya had two wives. He produced children in each of those wives, Dhritarashtra and Pandu. And here we have Dhritarashtra, the sons of Dhritarashtra. So Dhritarashtra was the oldest, and he was born of the older queen, but he was born blind. And as a blind man, he was not fit to be the king, because one of the duties of the king is to lead the battles. And so there was no way Dhritarashtra could be the king. Now, he and his wife Gandhari had 100 children. I think the record in modern times is 64. I'm pretty sure that's what it is. Somebody could look it up later. But I'm pretty sure that within the last 100-150 years, the most children that any couple, one man and one woman have had together is 64. But anyway, Gandhari and Dhritarashtra had 100. Actually, had 101. They had 100 sons and they had a daughter. Dhritarashtra also had a child by another woman. So these children would have become the king if Dhritarashtra was the king. And especially the oldest one, Duryodhan, felt that he should have become the king, because his father was the oldest and he was the oldest, so the title should have gone to him. But the kingdom went, instead of to Dhritarashtra, to Pandu, the younger son, and therefore Pandu's oldest son would have inherited the throne. You know, once it goes to the younger son, then that person's children would be the king. But part of the problem, or perhaps a huge part of the problem, was that Dhritarashtra himself was always unhappy with the fact that he hadn't been king, and that at least his son could have become the king. It wasn't just a problem of Duryodhana, it was really a problem of Dhritarashtra. Dhritarashtra had this attitude, and his children picked up on this attitude. It's interesting because his wife didn't share this mood, but the children picked up on it from their father, that they were the rightful heirs of the kingdom, that Pandu's sons were usurpers. And so they spent their whole life trying to kill their cousins, trying to kill the Pandu's children. And such things are quite common among royalty. I mean, nowadays, with our democratic system, it's pretty rare that, you know, there's assassinations taking place so somebody can take over the kingdom. You know, it just, that doesn't happen. But we do have, in the United States, just recently, we had strong evidence that other countries were manipulating our elections in 2016. And we have strong evidence that they're trying to do so now in 2020. In other words, that people are taking unfair means, that people are adopting unfair means to win a political post. And that's been going on for millions and millions and millions of years, that people will cheat and take unfair means in order to get power, in order to get money, in order to get influence, and so forth. And it goes to the point of assassination and murder. You know, that's not very unusual in world history. Or imprisonment, you know, or framing somebody for crimes they didn't commit. Or, you know, in our modern politics, we have a lot of innuendo. And our present president is not very subtle, and so it's hard to even call it innuendo. You know, he'll say, "Oh, my opponent is probably taking performance-enhancing drugs, and that's why he's speaking coherently." You know, so trying to slander the other person's character, even to the point of involving other countries, hacking things, and so many things. So this is bribery. Again, I don't think we have murders and assassinations going on in the United States for political power. Maybe, but I don't think so. But anyway, this is a very common, very, very common thing in the history of the world. And so Dhritarashtra's sons tried to murder their cousins in childhood. They had a murder attempt on Pandu's son Bhima when they were children in school. Evidently didn't work, and in fact Bhima became even stronger after that. Long story, not so terribly important. And after they all grew up, then Dhritarashtra's sons engineered a flammable building. It looked like a regular building, but it was built of materials that could burn very easily. They had the house set on fire, but Pandu's sons knew of it in advance, and they were able to escape through a tunnel. And after that, they lived for about a year incognito, and they lived basically by begging. And here Prabhupada talks about whether or not Arjuna was going to live by begging. So they were living in hiding, they were living by begging. And they didn't come out of their anonymity until they married Draupadi. When the sons of Pandu, all five brothers married the same woman, they all married Draupadi. When they married Draupadi, then they were aligned with the kingdom of her father, with the kingdom of Drupad. And now they had military strength by being aligned with Drupad, and they were able to go back and get some of their kingdom. But it didn't last long, and then the sons of Dhritarashtra then cheated in gambling and again exiled the Pandavas, and again they had to live without proper livelihood. And, you know, finally they came and they said, you know, Krishna actually came as a mediator to Dhritarashtra's sons. and said, look, you know, the Pandavas are royalty. They're meant to run government, and in order for them to live, they have to be taking care of people and living from tax money. You know, it's, or like a landlord who lives from rent, that's their job, that's their occupation, that's what they do. You know, there was a big sense in ancient times, and one which we would do well to revive, that people should have a livelihood that's commensurate with their propensities, with their nature. And so those who have the nature of taking care of people, those who have the nature of providing for people and taking care of people, are supposed to work in government. I mean, we're not talking about taking care of people like a nurse, but, you know, providing people with water and providing people with education, with health care, with parks, with roads, basically being like super parents. You know, so people who have this mood of being super parents and just taking care of everyone, defending them, protecting them. So in order for them to do that, they have to have some people to take care of. And then they're maintained by the taxes or the rent of the people that they take care of. And because that's their propensity, if they try to do something else, they're going to cause a disturbance in society. So if you have people who have the mentality of caring for everyone, you know, they put people before projects. They will empty their treasury in order to take care of everyone. If you try to have them run businesses, they'll bankrupt the business because they'll be so interested in taking care of everyone that they don't make a profit. Or they'll use the so-called profits of the business for social causes and the business will fail. If you put such people in charge of, you know, education and universities, because they're so practical-minded in their pursuit of knowledge, they will neglect taking the time and energy to look at more theoretical and philosophical ideas which are necessary for those in the teaching profession. Also, they have a tendency to fight and because they're very protective. And so they're going to cause a big problem in the intellectual realm. You really have a problem if you have people who are always fighting and who get easily offended and who are in this mood of, you know, protecting things. Another thing is that those in the intellectual realm are supposed to be interested in liberation and forgiveness, and those who are running government are supposed to be interested more in morals and ethics and in justice. And when you bring a heavy mood of justice into the realm of teaching or into the realm of religion, then you end up having something that's oppressive. Yeah. And if those who are suited for government end up as laborers or artisans, then they're going to be too impatient with looking at making a craft perfect. You know, they're big thinkers. They're just not going to have the patience for it. Actually, it was really interesting just the other day. The one devotee I know who's a police officer, so his wife was doing a big cleaning job. I was helping her, and I said, husband, why aren't you helping? And his wife said, no, don't ask him to do things like that. And he says he just makes a mess of it. Let him do his own work. You know, and so we're each meant to do our own work. We're meant to do work that's according to our propensities, that's according to our nature. And in former times, people only did other people's work very, very briefly in times of emergency. Otherwise, they stuck to their own work. And so the Pandavas, the sons of Pandu, because all of the land in the world was under the rulership at this point of Dhritarashtra and his sons, they had no people to take care of. They had no one to take care of. And therefore they had no legitimate means of maintenance. So Krishna went as a mediator and said, look, Duryodhana, Dhritarashtra, just give each brother a village, a little village. I mean, these were people that were capable of ruling the whole world. In fact, they had previously ruled the world and they will again. But he said, just give them a village, so they can at least have people that they're taking care of and they can maintain themselves by tax money. And Duryodhana said, I'm not going to give them as much land as we can stick a pin into. I'm not going to give them anything. So this really put the Pandavas into a very, very difficult situation where they didn't have any legitimate way of maintaining themselves. They didn't have a legitimate way of living. And at the same time, in order to get a legitimate way of living, they had to have a war. And in one sense, they'd be the ones starting the war. You know, you could say that Dhritarashtra and his sons started the war by illegally depriving the sons of Pandu of their land, illegally depriving them of their kingdom, insulting their wife, so many things. You could say that they had started the war, but as far as starting the fighting and declaring war, that was being done by the sons of Pandu, who said, all right, if you're not going to give us what's ours in a peaceful way, then we're going to have to fight for it. But this situation put Arjuna into a lot of distress because he was fighting with family. And even though Dhritarashtra's sons, like Duryodhan, had been very cruel to them and tried to kill them, they were still family. And I think that most of us have some experience in our family of having some difficult situation with a family member where you're kind of torn that, well, you know, I don't want to do anything that's going to hurt or upset my family member, even though the situation is very bad, even though, you know, they've done something they shouldn't have done, and so forth. And sometimes it's quite a conflict. I mean, one devotee I know was asking for advice because her husband's brother had been convicted of child molestation, three different children, one of which was his own daughter, and he had gone to jail for quite a while. He was convicted. So he'd gotten out of jail, and he had a mood of repentance. And so this devotee's husband wanted to have some relationship with his brother and try to help his brother and try to be there for his brother now that his brother was out of jail. And the wife was very conflicted. She said, you know, I want to help my husband to be kind to his brother, and at the same time, I have young children, and I'm not comfortable with having my brother-in-law, who's a convicted child molester, being around my children. What should I do? You know, what should I do? Do I have to divorce my husband? Do I have to say to my husband, well, if you're going to be kind to your brother, then I can't be married to you anymore. Is there some way that I can be kind to my brother-in-law without endangering my children? I mean, it was a very, very difficult situation. So it's sometimes, I mean, most of us are not in situations this extreme, but we may end up in situations like that where someone in the family does something that's just awful or very disturbing, and we kind of, you know, we don't know what to do. Do I cut myself off from this person? Do I have something to do with them? Do I have something to do with them this way or that way? And I really doubt that most of us would want to be in a situation where in order to fix things, we had to have a war with our family. You know, it's even if you really don't like your stepfather or your brother, or, you know, you probably don't want to kill them. And, you know, of course, there are civil wars in the United States. We had a civil war 150 years ago, and it happened that there were literally brothers on either side of a battlefield. And it was brother fighting against brother. I mean, it was father against son. We had that kind of a situation in the Civil War. It certainly happens, but it's considered most unfortunate. You know, these two branches of the family, Dhritarashtra's sons and Pandu's sons, if there was a common enemy, then they would join against the common enemy. But in this case, it was a fight among themselves. So Arjuna felt that he had three choices, all of them bad. So one is, okay, I'm going to fight and win. That sounds like a great option, but fight and win means I've killed my family members. And it's not just his family members. Also, fighting on the side of on the other side would be a Bhishma. So the Pandavas and the sons of Pandu, including Arjuna, their father had died when they were very young. And they were raised by Bhishma. They were raised by their great uncle Bhishma, who was called Grandfather Bhishma. He had no children of his own, but he was called Grandfather Bhishma. And he had raised them as a father substitute. There was great love between them. I'm like, okay, I got to fight with Bhishma. And then also their teacher, the teacher of all of these persons, Dhritarashtra's sons and Pandu's sons, Dronacharya, was also there. Again, there was great love and affection between Dronacharya and Pandu's sons, and so they didn't want to fight them. So, okay, I win the battle, but at what cost? You know, I win the battle, but by destroying my family members. And, you know, we see people do this kind of thing. We see people do this kind of thing, like in some divorces, we see this sort of thing, where the person, they win the case, and they destroy the lives of their children. You know, and they mess up the lives of, you know, the parents and the children. And so, you know, I won the case, I'm right. But what was the cost? There was some huge cost to the family. And, you know, as I say, we're not usually killing. Although sometimes that happens. Sometimes people murder their family members. But, you know, it's a very hollow victory. So, all right, I win the battle, and then my family's dead. That wasn't what the Pandavas wanted. They didn't want Dhritarashtra's... I mean, Dhritarashtra's sons wanted the Pandavas dead, but the Pandavas didn't want Dhritarashtra's sons dead. I mean, even if they had some feeling of enmity, and they're devotees, so they don't really, with Duryodhan, Dhritarashtra and his wife Gandhari were... Their aunt and uncle were also like substitute parents in a sense after the death of their father. And they didn't want to hurt them. So Arjuna's like, I don't want to win this battle at the cost of killing my relatives, at the cost of killing my teacher and my grandfather. So, okay, another option, you fight and lose. Well, then you die. You know, that's not a very good option. So we'll fight and lose, and we're better off just not fighting at all if we're going to lose. And then another option is you just walk away and you just say, well, I'm not going to fight. But then what are you going to do? You don't have anything. You don't have a home. You don't have a job. You know, his only choice, Prabhupada says, is by begging. And especially for those who have the mentality of running government, the kshatriyas, the concept of begging and accepting charity is anathema to them. They're the givers of charity. They're not the takers of charity. You know, that it's for them to think of, well, I'm going to take charity. And the Pandavas had to do that in their year when they ran away from the flammable house. They were disguised as brahmanas and they were accepting charity, but it wasn't something that they liked doing. And they certainly wouldn't want to spend the rest of their lives. It just would be a horrible situation for them. Their mood of the kshatriyas are to take care of others, not to be taken care of, not to be the recipients of charity. That's for the brahmanas and for the renunciates. It's for the brahmana householders and for the renunciates, but certainly not for the kshatriyas. So, you know, all of these were bad. I'm going to fight and win and kill my relatives. I'm going to fight and lose and die. And I'm going to walk away. And then I have to live in shame and infamy the rest of my life. I'm never going to have a satisfying career. I'm never going to have a satisfying life. I'm not going to do anything that's going to be pleasing. So what difficulty is that we can't avoid difficulty. You know, we often think, well, I'm going to set up my life in such a way that I just won't have these kind of problems. You know, good luck. I'm sure we've all noticed that we set up our lives so that we get rid of certain problems and everything's nice, and then there's another problem. Right? And then there's another problem. And then you finally fix all those problems, and then there's some other problem. Right? You know, you fix your leaky sink, and then your hot water heater breaks. And you fix your hot water heater, and then your mother gets sick. You know, it's always something. Or your mind is remembering old and finished problems as if you're living them again. So maybe you have no problems in the present, but your mind is going, oh, they said that to me 5 years ago, and this happened 10 years ago, and your mind is bringing all of your problems into your life. or your mind is going, well, this might happen in the future, and that might happen in the future, and this might happen in the future, and that might happen in the future. So even if we don't have any immediate problems, our mind can dwell in the past and in the future and remember so many problems or imagine so many problems. So it's not really that we can get rid of problems like that. You know, Arjuna's right. That whatever he chooses, there's a problem. And this is the reality for all of us. Whatever we choose, there's going to be some kind of problems. We're not going to be able to make a choice where there's no problem. And Arjuna's thinking, well, you know, I really just don't want to fight. He has this problem keeps coming up as we go through the next few chapters of the Bhagavad Gita, that I really just don't want to fight. Just forget the whole thing. And often we respond like this when we're stuck in this, you know, multi-lemma situation where we have lots of options that are all poor, and we just say, well, I'm just going to walk away from the whole thing. You know, I'm just not going to deal with it. You know, in extreme cases, a person might commit suicide, or somebody just, you know, takes a lot of intoxication, or just, what do they call it, binge watches, you know, every episode of some stupid show from 20 years ago, or something. You know, they just like try to escape. Just escape the situation. I'm just not going to deal with it, or I'm just not going to talk to that person anymore. Right? I think we all have ways of just kind of checking out. I'm just going to check out. I'm just not dealing with everything. Everything's just bad. But Prabhupada in his lecture on this verse talked about we can't avoid these situations. And Prabhupada talked a lot about how we can't avoid fighting. You know, I think one of the things that many of us try to avoid, some people look for fights. I even know some devotees who look for fights and try to instigate fights. I know. I even know some devotees who brag about instigating fights. But anyway, most of us try to avoid fighting. And at least the political leaders of the countries of the world claim that they try to avoid fighting. They all say, we're for peace, we're for peace. We don't want war, we don't want war. You know, the other guy started it. Even so extreme in the United States for the Vietnam War, the government completely manufactured a situation. What was it? Tonkin Gulf, I think. They just manufactured a situation that didn't even happen as a justification for entering the war. And I think the most extreme situation of which I'm aware was what Hitler did in World War II. So he wanted to invade Poland, and he knew that if he just went and invaded Poland, that England and France would attack him. Because, you know, after World War I, there had been these agreements. So what he did was he took German prisoners, I mean, not personally, he didn't do this. He had German prisoners taken out of jail, had them dressed in Polish military uniforms, and had them shot, and then put them on the Polish-German border by a crossing area. And then he claimed, just see, here they're, the Polish military have attacked our border, they've instigated this fight, and therefore we can invade Poland. And that was how World War II started. So we do have politicians who look for fights, who concoct reasons for fighting, who make up things. Or with Saddam Hussein, right, in the United States, the government just made up that he had weapons of mass destruction. They knew their intelligence wasn't very solid for that, but they just made it up anyway. Oh yeah, he's got weapons of mass destruction. We got to go in there. So, you know, many times they are itching for a fight, but at least they make propaganda that, oh, we're for peace and we want to avoid war. But Prabhupada, speaking about this verse, says that fighting is unavoidable. And he gives the example of little children. He says, little children have no politics, they have no ideologies, and still they fight. And it's a fact. You know, you see the little children, they fight. It's as soon as you have, you know, two brothers or brother and sister, or just little children playing together. And they will even instigate it. You know, a child will take another child's toy. And pokey kid, and right. I remember my son had, when he was maybe 9 or 10, he was complaining to me that the other kids were picking on him and hitting him. And when I went to the teacher said, watch carefully, so that the boys were all in a line. And I could see that the other kids were, that he was poking the other kids. And then after he would poke them, then they would hit him. So he was starting the situation. So children will do this, you know, they all, and then he was crying to me, you know, they're hitting me. So Prabhupada was saying that children will fight. Or Prabhupada talks about how husbands and wives will fight. I mean, I know some couples who say they've never had a fight, but generally speaking, there'll be some fight. Prabhupada said it shouldn't be taken seriously. He said the fight between husband and wife should be taken like if sages in the forest say they're going to have a festival. He said if they're just sages in the forest, what are they going to do? Pick some berries. You know, it's not going to be much of a festival. Or he says, you know, it's like lightning. It makes a lot of noise. And then life goes on. But there, it's like that. There's fighting between siblings. There's fighting between husband and wife. You know, just the nature of the thing. And Prabhupada said that ultimately the reason that we fight is because Krishna also likes to fight. There's some pleasure there. There's, of course, the Vira Ras. There's a chivalrous Ras. And when Krishna fights, of course, it's only fun. It's only pleasure, and it's all loving. Even when he fights with the demons, even when he fights with Durasunder and there's a river of blood, still, for Krishna, it's loving, and it's full of bliss. It's not malicious, and it's not cruel. But this tendency for wanting to fight, I mean, even in the spiritual world, Krishna and the cowherd boys, they're sometimes insulting each other and wrestling and fighting in different ways. And Krishna and the gopis also fight. Not the way boys fight, obviously, but the girls are, they're accusing Krishna of all kinds of things, and Krishna accuses them. And again, they instigate it. You know, Krishna will go to one girl and call her another girl's name and make her angry, or say he's going to come at a certain time and not show up. And so Krishna instigates these fights. And the gopis sometimes instigate them as well. And this is part of their pleasure. Actually, it's interesting when Krishna was talking to his wife, Rukmini, and he was saying, you know, you married the wrong man, it's not too late, you can divorce me and marry someone else. This was in a society where basically nobody got divorced. She already had grown children, and she's like, what is he talking about? It sounds like he wants to leave me. And she fainted. And then Krishna picked her up and he said, you know, I didn't expect you to do that. He said, I wanted to enjoy some arguing with you. He said, the householders, their happiness is after a long day of work. They can sit around and joke with one another. And he said, I was looking for a joking argument with you. And when she understood that, then she did some repartee and they had this kind of friendly argument. But the point is, this exists spiritually. I often talk about how in Brihad Bhagavatamrita, when Gopakumar goes to Vaikuntha, he's addressing Lord Vishnu as Gopal, a cowherd. And I mean, even today, if you say someone's a village boy, you know, or you're just like a shepherd boy, uneducated, country bumpkin, or we would say in America, a hick. Right, or a redneck, it's kind of insulting. It means that you're not a sophisticated person, you're not a well-educated person, kind of crude, right? So to go to Vaikuntha and look at Lord Vishnu and say, oh, hey, cowherd. So the residents of Vaikuntha took this as being a little insulting, and they said to Gopakumara, you know, you really can't talk to the Lord like this. They said, we know that the Lord takes the form of a cowherd boy in order to kill demons, and we accept that that's one of his incarnations, but, that's not the way to talk to him. And then another group said, well, you know, you can call the Lord by any of his incarnation names. I mean, it's interesting, like the word matsya just means fish, and the word kurma just means turtle. You know, so if you just say Kurma, means just turtle, you know, you say Kurma avatar. So the incarnation of the Lord is a turtle. So anyway, they were having a fight. They weren't physically fighting, but the residents of Vaikuntha were having an argument. They were having a debate where, you know, what are we going to call the Lord? So because that exists in, among the devotees, among with the Lord, in the spiritual world, we have this tendency. And therefore, in this world, although in this world most of the fighting is malicious and cruel and selfish, it's not that the fighting is going to be avoided. So Arjuna's idea that he's just going to avoid the whole thing, well, you know, we don't have to fight after all, you know, we'll just accept the situation, then we'll have to be beggars, and you know, that wasn't going to work. It wasn't just, the point, it wasn't really that the Pandavas were the instigators. The point wasn't really that if the Pandavas backed down, there wouldn't be a fight, because Dhritarashtra's sons kept picking fight anyway. So the point that Prabhupada makes in I'm just going to get some water, I'll be right back, or I can just ask someone else to get me some water. The point that Srila Prabhupada makes here is that Prabhupada in his lecture on this verse jumps ahead and gives us the solution that one has to act without attachment, that one has to act without material attachment, that one has to act for the pleasure of Krishna. That are the reason Arjuna, and this is the secret, the reason Arjuna was having problems was not the situation. I mean, it looks like it's a situation. His cousins have stolen this kingdom, tried to kill him and his brothers and their mother, insulted his wife, refused to have any kind of mediation or negotiation. Completely unreasonable. It seemed like that situation was the problem, but it wasn't. The problem was Arjuna's way of thinking. He was thinking, what are the pros and cons for me? I'll feel bad if I win the kingdom at the cost of my relatives' lives. I don't want to die. And I'll be miserable and frustrated living as a beggar. So in each of these cases, he was thinking about how he would feel and what it would be like for him. Now, even as a kshatriya, on a mundane level, he should have been thinking about what was good for the citizens, not what was good for himself. The mood of the kshatriyas is always what's good for the country, what's good for the citizens. Now, of course, Arjuna was thinking about that in other verses where he talked about how the women would be unprotected and the traditions wouldn't go on. So he was, we want to give him credit for thinking about the citizens and thinking about the country. He wasn't just thinking about himself. But in this verse, he's thinking just about himself. And he's saying, you know, how is this going to work out for me? But even just thinking of the citizens, one has to think of the boss, right? You have to think ultimately, what does the boss want? Because even the citizens, they're not really Arjuna's citizens. They're Krishna's citizens. It was really Krishna who's the king of kings. The kings, the government leaders, are really ruling on his behalf. So it really is, I'm a servant. You know, if you're a Brahmana, the greatest intellectual and philosopher is Krishna. If you're in the government, the head of all the governments, the king of kings, is Krishna. If you're in business and trade and agriculture, well, the supreme cowherder and agriculturist is Krishna. The husband of the earth is Krishna. And if you're an artisan and a craftsperson, a laborer, so this supreme artist is also Krishna. Right? When Krishna dances on Kaliya, the master of all fine arts such as dancing, Prabhupada says. So really, the person, that the boss is always Krishna. Whatever realm of work we're doing, we're always working as, whether we know it or not, whether we admit it or not, whether we acknowledge it or not, whether we work in that consciousness or not, the person that we're really supposed to be pleasing is the boss. And the boss in all situations, in all occupations, in everything, is Krishna. So when we're asking about other things, we're really asking the wrong question. You know, if I'm asking, well, how will this just be good for me, or how will it be good for the citizens, or how will it be good for the customers, or how will it be good for the students, or how will it be good for the planet? I really should be asking, how will this be good for Krishna? And then those other questions are automatically answered, because what Krishna likes is going to be good for the planet and the cows, and what Krishna likes is going to be good for the customers, and what Krishna likes is going to be good for the citizens, what Krishna likes will be good for the students, and what Krishna likes is going to be good for me. You know, we tend not to really believe that. But we're part of Krishna, so, you know, when I drink water, when my hand works to give me this glass of water, that water hydrates my hand as well. So, you know, we tend to think that, well, if I just work for Krishna, what about me? Who's going to think about me? Who's going to take care of me? But because I'm part of Krishna, if I work to please him, I automatically am satisfied. And everybody that I'm meant to please and everybody that I'm meant to satisfy will also become satisfied. And then one works without attachment to the results. Right? One works just to please Krishna without thinking, what's in it for me? You know, it's like if you're an employee in a company, you work for the benefit of the company, you work for the benefit of the boss, and you get your paycheck. You know, you don't need to think of that separately. You can just absorb yourself, if it's a good company, you can absorb yourself in working for the company. Now, Arjuna is just about, in the next verse, to ask Krishna what to do, to accept Krishna as his guru. And Prabhupada points out how Arjuna's mentality here very much qualifies him to be a disciple. Now, we often look at what are the qualifications of a guru. It's a big discussion in the Hare Krishna movement, who is and is not qualified to be a guru. And perhaps we don't talk so much about who is and is not qualified to be a disciple. So here we're looking at Arjuna. So Arjuna is able to control his mind. Although he's very emotional at this point in the Bhagavad Gita, you know, his throat is dried up, his hairs are standing on end, his bow is slipping from his hand. Prabhupada said he was probably also crying. So although he was very upset, I mean, I've only had such extreme physical symptoms due to fear and upsetness maybe once or twice in my life, that I was in such a scary situation that, you know, my throat just kind of dried up and I was crying. I wasn't carrying a bow, so I don't know if my bow would have been slipping from my hands. But, I mean, he was very, very emotional. And yet, even though all these emotions were flowing through him, still he had the presence of mind to consider all these arguments from the scriptures, all the different points of view, all the different pros and cons. And he was sense-controlled. He wasn't going to fight just simply to gain the kingdom and power and riches the way did Duryodhana and his brothers were acting. He had enough sense control to say, you know, I can walk away from this if I need to. I don't need to do this for myself. And he had that detachment. I mean, it wasn't just some kind of an aversion. Arjuna had some genuine detachment that, you know, hey, I don't want to do something that's going to be harmful. I don't want to do something that's going to harm the citizens. I don't want to do something that's going to harm my family. I don't want to do something that's going to harm myself. And to think like that and act on like that takes quite a lot of detachment and sense control. You know, in the mode of ignorance, people just do whatever they feel like doing, thinking about the immediate future without considering what the long-term consequences are going to be for themselves or others. And Arjuna is not like that. You know, in the modes of passion, the mode of goodness, one really thinks about the consequences and really considers and is able to step back and say, you know, well, even though I really want this, or even though I really don't want this, because of the consequences, I'm going to restrain myself, and I'm going to do what's best in the long run for everyone, even though it may not be the thing that feels good in this moment. Right? That's the mark of a human being as compared to an animal. So he had this mood. Also, he was very faithful. He was a very loyal person. He was loyal to his older brother. And the loyalty of the Pandavas to Yudhisthira, considering that Yudhisthira gambled them away and gambled away their wife, is kind of astonishing. And he was even loyal to Bhishma and Drona. He was even loyal to Dhritarashtra and Duryodhan, that he wasn't willing to hurt even those who hurt him. So this was a great, great quality, and very tolerant. You know, the Kurus had tried to kill them on many occasions and cheated them and insulted them. And still he was very tolerant. He was not going to just retaliate, and he was not going to engage, even though, as Prabhupada said, his cause was justified. Still, he would prefer to tolerate. And tolerate doesn't mean like tolerate, but he would prefer to be forgiving, and he preferred to let it go. And these qualities of Arjuna made him a fit disciple. It meant that when he was going to ask Krishna in the next verse to help him, that he was likely to listen to Krishna, and he was likely to put Krishna's instructions into practice. Right? You know, when you're teaching somebody, you want to teach somebody who wants to learn. I remember, you know, when I was teaching children, and so sometimes, you know, the kids would come up with some question or complaint, and they would just be arguing, and I'd look at them and say, do you want to argue or do you want to learn? You know, you just want to argue with me, or do you actually want to learn what's going on? I don't know what to do. It's just like we were listening, Bir Krishna Swami was saying in his class yesterday, how so many disciples, you know, when you give them an instruction, they'll be like, well, I don't want to give up that attachment, and I don't want to give up that attachment, and I don't want to give up that attachment. It's like, well, if that's not what you want, then why are you here? You know, someone goes to a doctor, and the doctor says, okay, well, follow this diet. Well, I'm not going to follow that diet. We do this exercise. Well, I don't want to do that exercise. Too much trouble. Take these medicines. Oh, I had one time a very good friend who hated taking any kind of medicine. And she was staying with me for a while. And she had something was wrong. I can't remember what it was. And I said, would you like some herbal tea? You know, I don't want to take anything. And she was complaining. I said, if you're not willing to do anything, then don't just sit around complaining. Right? It's quite common, isn't it? That people, they ask for help, but then they don't actually want the help that you give. Periodically I get people asking me to edit their books or their articles and to give them feedback on what they've written. And I always first say, are you sure you want me to do that? I said, I was trained by Jai Dwaita Swami as an editor, and I'm kind of a heavy-duty editor. You know, do you really want it? Because you see, a lot of times people ask for that, and when you actually give comments on their writing, which to them are like their baby, you know, they just get so offended. You didn't like that sentence? That was a wonderful sentence. I worked for a year on that one sentence. How can you tell me that it's not good? And I've had that kind of experience where people ask you, you know, for feedback, and you give them feedback, and it's the last thing they wanted. All they wanted you to do was say, oh, it's wonderful, it's wonderful. And so sometimes I'll ask that, you know, are you just wanting some encouragement for me? Do you just want some praise? Or do you actually want some honest feedback? And sometimes people will say, oh, I just wanted to, you know, get you to endorse my book. I don't really want any feedback on it. So here Arjuna is proving himself to be qualified. He can control his mind, he can control his senses. He's detached. Right? He's loyal, he's faithful, he's tolerant, he's very mature. So he's, of course, he is going to question Krishna. Tadvidi pranipatena pray prashnina sarya. One is supposed to ask questions. It's not that he doesn't, it's not that he just says blindly, yes, sir. Prabhupada says blind following is condemned. But at the same time, he accepts that Krishna is his master and he wants to learn from him. So this is what we do in our, and I realize that saying this is jumping ahead of this particular verse, but as Prabhupada did that in his lecture on the verse, so I'll follow in his footsteps. The way we get out of our perplexities is not so much by analyzing the situation as it is because there's no situation that we're going to analyze that's going to be all good. And if we think we found something that's all good, then we probably just don't know enough about it yet. You know, once we're in it for a while, we'll go, oops, this is bad. And this is bad, and there's this problem. You know, Prabhupada said there's no one is completely happy or completely unhappy in this world. There's always going to be some difficulty. So I'm not saying we shouldn't make any adjustment in our circumstances, but it's not that adjustment in the circumstances is going to solve the whole problem. The main thing we want to do is adjustment in our consciousness. Now, sometimes what happens is when we adjust our consciousness, we can then see clearly to see how to adjust our circumstances. Whereas when we just look at adjusting our circumstances while we're in a haze of unconnectedness from Krishna, we can't even figure out how to adjust our circumstances. So first we adjust our consciousness and say, oh, I'm supposed to be working for Krishna's pleasure. I'm supposed to be Krishna's servant. What does Krishna want here? And then everybody always asks the question, how do you know what Krishna wants? How do you know what Krishna wants? I think a lot of the times when people ask that, they're thinking, well, if I just knew what Krishna wanted, and I did that, then I won't have any problems in my situation. But that doesn't happen either. It's not that because Arjuna fights this battle on Krishna's order that there was no negative consequences. There were lots of negative consequences, and some of them even Arjuna had anticipated. There were a lot of unprotected women. There was a destruction of family tradition. All of the Pandavas' children were killed. They had only one descendant that survived. That was a grandson in utero. I mean, it was awful. So it was so awful that Maharaj Yudhisthira was upset after the battle for a long time, after the war for a long time. He was like, all these terrible things have happened just to make me the king. And he felt very guilty and so forth. So a lot of times people think like that, well, the reason I should find out Krishna's desire is everything God wants is good, and therefore if I align my intention with his intentions, everything will work out good from my perspective. But that's not necessarily true. What Krishna sees as good, what Krishna sees as beneficial for the world, may not line up with my idea as to what's good and what's beneficial. Just like, you know, what a child thinks, compared to Krishna, I'm like a little child, I'm like a little insect, really. You know, and the parent may say to the child, it's time to go to bed, and the child has a tantrum, I don't want to go to bed. Or the parent says, you know, you have to eat your broccoli before you have your cupcake, and the child thinks that that's, you know, grounds for torture, and they can invoke the constitution against unfair punishment. And so, you know, children think like that, or I've given the example that I take a walk early in the morning and sometimes there's earthworms that have come out of the ground and they're on the road. And so I know that it's a big enough road. By the time they cross the road, they'll be dead. They'll have dried out and they'll be dead. And I pick up the earthworms and I put them back in the ground. But the earthworms get very upset. When you pick up the earthworm thinks that that you're a hawk or something, you know, or a crow or whatever. And it's just wiggling all over the place trying to get away from you, thinking, you know, you're my enemy, you're my enemy, you're my enemy. Huh? So we're very small. Our senses are very limited. We don't actually understand what's good. What appears bad to us may be good. What appears good to us may be bad. But the reason we want to align ourselves with Krishna is because then we will feel happy and satisfied regardless of the external circumstances, because that's the key. The key isn't let me shift the external circumstances. The key is let me shift my internal perception of them. And there's a lot of people, even, you know, impersonalists and voidists and etc., who talk about, you know, being very present in the moment, very mindful in the moment, and very grateful for whatever's happening in the moment. And someone who's connected with Krishna finds that that happens as a natural side effect. One is conscious of Krishna and everything in Krishna's direction, and sees that God is all good and God is all merciful and everything is perfect. Even things that may not appear to be perfect, and even things that may appear to be, you know, something horrific like those poor little earthworms are thinking. And how do I know what Krishna wants? I know what Krishna wants, first of all, from the Shastra. So the Shastra is telling us in a general way for everyone. Shravanam Kirtanam Smaranam Vandanam Padasevam. You know, I should hear about Krishna, I should chant about him, I should remember him. Then the Shastra is telling us what to do according to our age. You know, when you're young, you go to school. When you're in the prime of life, you have a family and a career. When you're in middle age, you retire. When you're in old age, you prepare for death and detachment. If you have, you know, a certain kind of mentality, then you work in intellectual things. You have another kind of mentality, you work at making money and in agriculture. Another mentality, you work in crafts and in making society function. Another kind of mentality, you work at taking care of people. So we have these general instructions. Then when it comes to specific, we have the saintly persons who show us specific examples, and we have guru. That doesn't mean with guru that we ask the guru about everything. You know, so many years ago I had this one devotee who said, "Arjuna, I want you to be my shiksha guru." I'm like, "Well, we can try and see if that relationship works." And she said, "Would you like me to learn to play the mridanga?" And I said, "Well, if you want to, you know, it's fine, it'd be nice." And then she said, "Should I buy a red mridanga or a blue mridanga?" I said, "I don't care, buy whatever color mridanga you want." She says, "Well, if you won't tell me what color mridanga to buy, then I'm not going to learn how to play the mridanga." I said, "Fine, then don't learn how to play the mridanga." She said, "But you told me to learn how to play the mridanga." I said, "I didn't tell you to learn how to play the mridanga. I said it was fine if you wanted to play the mridanga." Eventually, I had to just tell her, "Listen, you know, I'm sorry, I can't help you anymore. Ask somebody else to be your guru," because she would do that all the time. And then she would have a whole crying fit. "You don't care about me. You're not telling me what we're not going to buy." So it's not like that. It's not that we need to consult with the guru, you know, "Do I wear my red shoes today or my blue shoes today? You know, or should I eat sweet rice at 11 or eat sweet rice at 1 o'clock? Like I had been given sweet rice this morning, and I was thinking, should I eat the sweet rice before my class? Because I had my dinner then. I thought, should I eat the sweet rice with my dinner? I thought, nah, if I do that, then I'll be tired. And then I'll be too tired to give the class. But, you know, I have to, like, let me meditate on Srila Prabhupada. Srila Prabhupada, what should I do? Should I eat the sweet rice now or tomorrow morning?" You know, it's not like that. Oh, it doesn't have to pester the guru with every little thing. You know, like Prabhupada told the story when he was a little boy. He was very young, that, you know, he asked his mother's permission if he could go use the toilet. And she's like, "Why do you have to ask my permission? You know, just go." So, you know, it's not like that. Then we're just annoying. But the idea is that guru also gives us instructions that are personal for us. So from the Shastra, we get general instructions. From the examples of the sadhus, we get general instructions. From the guru, we can get more specific instructions. And of course, we have Krishna in the heart. Desham sadatayutanam bhajatam priti purvakam didami puriyogam tam yena mamupayantite. Krishna is the Chaita Guru. And he can also give us instructions from within the heart like that, how to act. And sometimes we do find that the Shastra and the saintly persons, even those who are long departed, give us very specific instructions. I mean, sometimes we have some questions, some doubt, we don't know what to do, and we open this Shastra and there's the answer. You know, you read something from one of the acharyas and it's like, aha, there it is. So we're always in perplexity, like Arjuna. As I said, you know, we're always having some problems, what to do, what not to do. And the solution is to change our consciousness, to say, What would Krishna like me to do? How can I work to please Krishna? And you know what? Even if apparently Krishna is not pleased, the intention of wanting to please Krishna is enough. That's also, you know, why we always think I have to get it perfectly right. We think I have to get it perfectly right so then my life will be perfect externally. No, sorry, that doesn't work like that. We also think I'd want to get it perfectly right because, you know, I have to know exactly what Krishna wants. It's kind of like you ask somebody what they want for your birthday and they give you a link to something online and you just buy exactly what they want. Right? We think, okay. But, you know, sometimes you can buy a present for somebody without them doing that. You can just buy something that you think they'll like. We were talking about Rukmini, how Rukmini didn't argue with Krishna. And Krishna said, but I wanted you to argue with me. And still he was so pleased by her devotion. Or an example that's given by in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu is when Mother Yasoda put little Krishna down when she was breastfeeding him, and she put him down to tend to the milk. Krishna was very angry and he broke the pot. He wasn't pleased. Yasoda Mayi was thinking, this is Krishna's milk on the stove. But yet Krishna wasn't pleased. And yet that's bhakti. Because Mother Yasoda's intention was to please Krishna. Whereas Kamsa had no intention to please Krishna, and even though Krishna enjoyed fighting with him, Kamsa is not considered to be in bhakti. Now, we can't just say, well, I'm going to smoke marijuana with the intention of pleasing Krishna. It's got to be something in the Shastra and authorized by Guru. But, you know, the little details, if our intention is to please Krishna, and we're working in the purview of Guru, Sadhu, Shastra, then it's perfect. Then everything we do is perfect, and then there's no reaction to what we do. Yagya shisachina santoma chate sarvakyobishai punjate te tikam papaye de chatmat yadviparanat. Yagya shisachina santoma chate sarvakyobishai. So we have this understanding that if I do everything in this mood of sacrifice for Krishna, to please Krishna, then I'm not beset by these perplexities. Then instead of all the choices are bad, and I see, oh, whatever, you know, however this works out, it will be good. It will be something good. So we'll stop here. If anyone has any questions, I guess people on Facebook, they can type in questions and someone can type that in here. So you can ask the guru, you know, if there's something that you read and you study and you're confused, then you can certainly ask the guru, just like Arjuna is asking Krishna about his doubts and his difficulties. And you can certainly ask the guru about questions in your life, but the guru may say with some things, you know, that's up to you. But you certainly don't want to be pestering the guru every minute of the day. You know, do I put my right foot forward or my left foot forward? And what color socks do I wear? And things like that. Don't ask the guru about the minutiae of your life. Imagine if a guru had, you know, 30 disciples and they were all asking about the minutiae of their life all the time. So the guru would get to do their own sadhana. That was a very nice question. Anybody else?
Hare Krishna, Ramila Devidasi.
Hare Krishna.
My obeisances. I actually have a question that my mother gave me today. I'm reading the Bhagavad Gita in Spanish. I was reading the Bhagavad Gita in Spanish with her, and she had a very interesting question. She asked me, our background is Catholic, and she was like, why? She's conflicted as to why there's a difference between, she's like, in the Bible, it all starts with God creating the world, and that's how the quote-unquote story starts. And she's like, but I don't understand why the Bhagavad Gita, which to her, she equates like equivalent, why you would start with a war. And I tried explaining, I'm so glad that you did the recap of the family, because I'm going to try to remember that way you recapped it, because it was so beautifully done, so I could do that again with her. But I tried to start, and then she still didn't get it. So I have a feeling that maybe there's some disconnect that I'm not quite getting and explaining it to her.
We have a book available. You can get it as a free PDF, or you can buy a printed book on Amazon. It's called Bhagavad Gita, An Illustrated Introduction. And we have a synopsis there of the background information for the Bhagavad Gita. So the Bhagavad Gita is really a piece of a much greater work. It doesn't really start... And, you know, when I first read the Bhagavad Gita, I was also like, who are these people? What's going on here? You know, all these names in that first chapter, which, you know, not coming from an Indian background, I didn't even know how to pronounce them. You know, Duryodhana, who is that? You know, and I sometimes tell people, just start with chapter 2, because it can get very overwhelming. But explain to her that Bhagavad Gita is a philosophical discussion that's really in the middle of a story. The Bhagavad Gita doesn't start with the Bhagavad Gita. We publish it as a separate book because as a philosophical discussion, it can be understood that way. But the context, the story in which it takes place, is very important, at least in the beginning, for understanding what's going on with Arjuna. If you look at the Srimad Bhagavatam, now it's interesting, the Srimad Bhagavatam starts with a story of sages who are wondering how to achieve perfection and knowledge. And then it goes quite quickly to this a similar story of what's informing the Bhagavad Gita. What's happening with the Pandavas, what's happening with Krishna. And then by the second canto, it's getting into the creation of the universe, the creation of all the elements. But the first canto is you're also getting into these stories, but you have stories within stories within stories within stories within the Bhagavatam. But we do have this, we definitely have many descriptions in the second canto, particularly of the creation. So you could say, you know, very early in the beginning of the Bhagavatam, it's like that. I think another reason why we don't just absolutely start with the creation, why do we start in the Bhagavatam pretty close to the beginning with the Lord's pastimes, is that our philosophy is that the Lord has his own life, so to speak, beyond this creation. You know, the Bible says next to nothing about what does God do when he's not running the world. Practically nothing. I mean, like Jesus says, my Father's home has many mansions in it. Okay, well, that's a whole lot of information. Right? You know, you read Moses saw God face to face, like a friend speaks with another friend, but then there's another place that says no one has seen God's face and lived. So you're not quite sure, you know, can you see God's face? Can you not see God's face? And the Song of Solomon has all this description of the form of the Lord, but people take it all as just metaphor. And what does God do? I don't know. He's a pillar of smoke, he's a pillar of fire, he's a burning bush that's not consumed. You know, I guess if you take Jesus as God, but okay, but that's not what God's going to do all eternity. Preach to some people and get crucified. I mean, it's just like, so the Vedic scriptures are explaining what God does that's separate from the material creation. What he does in his own home. The material creation is a very, very small part of the energies of the Lord. And while the Bhagavatam and the Bhagavad Gita give a lot of space and a lot of attention to the nature of this world, much more so than the Bible does, to the nature of this world, how it works, about reincarnation, karma, the modes of nature, how God is creating. I mean, the biblical description of how God creates is a few sentences. You know, in the Bhagavatam, it's chapters and chapters. I mean, even in the Bhagavad Gita, there's more than what's in the Bible. But in the Bhagavatam, it's chapters and chapters. How the Lord creates. How he manifests the material world. But there's also a lot of information about beyond the world. What is the ultimate reality? But yeah, as far as the Bhagavad Gita, you can't... the Bhagavad Gita, to compare it to the Bible, is not really that accurate. You know, the Bible has so many stories in it, also of many wars and many families, and the Bible also has a lot of rules. You know, you'd be better off comparing the whole Bhagavatam, the whole 12 cantos of the Bhagavatam, to the Bible. In terms of the Bhagavatam is going to give you rules for worship. I mean, not as detailed as the Bible. It's going to give you some very specifics. And then the Bhagavatam has a multiplicity of stories that are also involving, you know, various battles and various people's inner conflicts and how the Lord is working in their lives, as well as how the Lord is working in his own world. So I really say the Bhagavatam is much more, I mean, it's a lot bigger. You know, the Bible's one little book, and the Bhagavatam takes a whole shelf and a half, but it'd be much more the equivalency in terms of the content and the range.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Ramamachi, so I felt like you were helping elucidate the meaning of chapter 4, text 34, the Bhagavad Gita, approach a guru, inquire from the guru or the teacher, submissively render service unto the guru. So, and you gave an example of what not to do, or the incorrect application and understanding of that verse for someone who's asking, my dear guru, can I do something that of course you can do? And if I do it, should it be like, let me ask something totally superficial. Should it be this color or that color? So irrelevant subject matter. So you explain how that is not the appropriate application of the verse, and it reflects an improper understanding of it. So I was thinking of another one, and I was hoping you could perhaps shed some light on this. Would it be an incorrect and, I guess, risky application, way to approach the idea of taking a guru, if one takes a guru who has vast numbers of disciples and would rarely have the opportunity to be in touch with one, and one with whom one would rarely associate in person, all that, unless that disciple also takes up the mood of a disciple towards or something close to that of being a disciple with another devotee whom one associates much more in depth, a senior devotee who can provide direct who knows one and provide some direct guidance and answer questions as well?
Yes and no. So you have, Srila Prabhupada said that he met with his spiritual master only maybe a dozen times in his life. And you have, you know, Narada Muni had the association of the Bhakti Vedantas only a short time when he was a young boy. You have Gopal Kumar, who saw his guru just a little bit here and there. So that can be there. And does one need other people in one life? Well, there's always the sadhus. So that depends. You know, that's, I think, something on a very individual level. And it also depends on the view of the guru. So if a guru says to you, look, you know, I have 60,000 disciples, like Durvasa Muni described, he had 60,000 disciples. That's a lot of disciples. 60,000. I mean, seriously, you know, the research shows that a normal human being can only have a close relationship with a maximum of 150 people. And you can say, well, someone's specially empowered, whatever, but, you know, most of us jivas are not capable of having a close relationship with 60,000 people. So if you want to become the disciple of someone, of Durvasa Muni, you know, Durvasa Muni might say, well, you can become my disciple, but I'm not going to be in a position to give you, to really even know you. I'm not going to be in a position to be able to guide you personally because I'm not going to be able to know anything about you. And so therefore, if you want to be my disciple, you're going to have to work with one of my senior students who can mentor you and guide you in that way. And then you have to decide if that's cool with you. I mean, that's very much what Srila Prabhupada did once the movement got large enough, where he told us, you know, we had to listen to our temple presidents and the senior devotees. I mean, senior, you know, talking, when I joined, a senior devotee was someone who'd been in the movement for 3 or 4 years. You know, they were really senior. So people were in the movement 6 months and they went and started a temple. But that was the understanding. You know, Srila Prabhupada would accept you as a disciple with the proviso that you were going to take guidance from his students. You know, you could write him a letter and he'd reply, but we were basically told not to write him letters, that he was answering 25 letters a day and he needed to translate and so forth. So that depends, you know. If a person wants a guru who can give them a lot more personal attention, then they can accept a guru who only has 10 disciples or 15 disciples or 2 disciples. And that depends on the guru also. So that's a very personal choice. It's a very individual kind of situation. And I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all answer. And if one is drawn to have a spiritual master who's definitely not going to be able to give you much personal guidance, then it should be something that's discussed. You know, how do you want to deal with me? I mean, that's true even if your guru only has 3 disciples, but especially if they have 60,000. And you want to ask, well, how do I receive guidance from you? And they'll say, well, I have this set up and this arrangement and that arrangement, and this is the way that I choose to guide my disciples, and then you can accept it or not. You can say, well, this isn't going to work for me, or, you know, yes, this is something that I want to do. And that's...
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
I've been dealing with this question for a little while. It's transcendence of place. Because now I do have spiritual activities, and I read the Bhagavad Gita, and I do things of, you know, one assumes that it's transcendence, even though I don't feel that it's transcendence, and I don't feel that, you know, God is working in life. Because I feel, you know, I don't feel moved. I just feel, well, I went from, you know, conventional life to a spiritual life. And yet, which is not the truth, but you know what I'm saying? But because I've been at it in some way or other for a number of years. But transcendence is not a place. It's a place where you can see yourself growing in some way. Mm. And that God is working in your life. So, yeah, how do you feel about that? I mean, I can read Bhagavad Gita, I can do a number of disciplines, yet I don't feel transcendent. It's not that I don't feel transcendent. I am in a transcendent place, but I'm not really transcending. Okay.
There's this... It's kind of a catch-22. That in one sense, we want to be very sincere and apply ourselves and take up spiritual discipline. On the other hand, if we feel that we're the doer and transcendence is something that we're going to achieve through our disciplines and what we do, then we haven't really changed our basic mentality at all. Transcendence is something we already are. The soul is factually already transcendent.
What I'm talking about is
that experience.
God or Krishna working in our lives. When you feel that there's movement. Because sometimes this discipline can be done very... you went to school. I don't know if you like school or not. I mean, there's not a culture. You see, you know, they ask you to do homework, you do homework. They ask you to do math, you do math. You have to learn math, you do math. Actually, do you feel you know, you're moving on by the grace of Krishna. This is what I'm talking about.
One needs to feel that. Yes, but you're not necessarily going to feel it at every moment.
And that, I feel that's been sometimes when you actually feel that your life has movement, has you know, action, so to speak, and you're moving from just being a student to being an active participant in whatever Krishna assigns to you.
Definitely. It's to a large extent, it is a subjective experience that one will feel that way. Is that what you're asking? Whether or not it's a subjective experience?
Well, I'm asking when it's, you know, why I don't feel moving. I don't feel that I'm taking an active role in, you know, Arjuna was in suspension, so to speak. He had to go on a fight, you know, and he wasn't fighting, and until he finally went to fight. I feel the same way. I feel that something has to happen in my life that engages me in battle, so to speak.
Well, what you might want to do is think about what kind of things you really enjoy and you're really good at, and think of some way that you can help Lord Chaitanya's mission through what you enjoy and what you're good at. There's plenty of battles out there to be fought. The world's a mess. There's no lack of things to be done.
But I feel that I also want to have meaning Krishna's either Krishna's blessings or Krishna's approval or fulfill Krishna's desire.
Okay, well, Krishna has a desire that everybody be happy and love for him. And Krishna will approve anything you do in Lord Chaitanya's mission that's within the general purview. Prabhupada says Krishna is not narrow or stereotyped. That you can help people to fall in love with Krishna. You definitely have Krishna's approval for that. So take something you like to do. Do you like to make cookies and give them out to people? Do you like to give people books? Do you like to just be there as Krishna's representative and just be kind to people? Just to, what does Krishna say? Not to be envious, but to be a kind friend to all living entities. Do you want to spread love of God just through who you are and your example as you interact in the world? What did Saint Francis say? Saint Francis said you should always be teaching and sometimes use words. So, you know, you can be spreading love of God just through who you are. But anything that you do to spread love of God to others, whether it's an earthworm on the that wandered in the middle of the street, you know, I pick up the earthworm and I'm thinking, Krishna will be happy if I put the earthworm back in the grass. Krishna's not going to be happy if I cold-heartedly walk by this earthworm that I know is going to its death. Because I'm on my japa walk. Krishna will be happy if I have compassion for this creature, even though the creature has no idea that I'm trying to be compassionate and certainly has no idea that I'm chanting Hare Krishna. I can't give the creature any prasadam. The only thing it eats is dirt. I mean, I know Krishna eats dirt, but I don't think we offer Krishna dirt and then give it as prasadam to the earthworms. You know, I can't really do much. I don't know how much they can hear. But I can do that to please Krishna. Why not? It's a simple thing. And that's not more or less pleasing to Krishna than my talking about Bhagavad Gita to all of you.
I feel that anything initiated by me is part of my conditioned being and is my false sense of ego.
Oh, that's okay. That's all right. You got to start with... You got to start with where you are. Then you're just paralyzed because, okay, I can't act until I'm pure, but the way I'm going to become pure is to act. And then you're just stuck in an endless loop. First, I've got to be transcendent, then I can act. By acting with the desire to please Krishna, you'll experience transcendence. Yes, a lot of it's based on your ego. I'm sure part of the reason I pick up the earthworms is so I can think, I'm such a wonderful person. I'm sure that's there. And I can think, wow, I am kind even to the earthworms. Just see. And there I am walking on the street in the early morning. No one else is there. Of course, I'm telling you all about it, so now I can get profit, adoration, and distinction from telling all of you. But, you know, when I'm on the dark street in the middle of the night, who sees me picking up the earthworm? Nobody. The moon, I suppose. The deer. But I can still be doing it out of ego and think, oh, I even care about the lowly earthworms. What a great saintly person I am. Doesn't matter. It doesn't matter that it's contaminated. It's all I have. If all I have is my present contaminated self, then that's all I can give. You know, if the only charity I have is an old $1 bill in my wallet, then that's the only charity I have. If somebody's really in need and I say, oh, I gotta wait till I have $1 million, then I'll give you some money. If all I have is an old crumpled up $1 bill, then that's what I can give. So maybe all I have to give Krishna right now is this very ego-tainted, you know, very selfish, it's all I have. You know, I don't know if she's still here. She was talking about the Bible where this widow gives the last of her money. And Jesus said she gave more than the person who gave, you know, hundreds. That's all I have. All right, I'll give that. And by giving that, Krishna's pleased. And by Krishna being pleased, he loosens some of this ego. And then pretty soon what I give him has less and less and less and less and less ego in it. I have to start from where I am. I can't start from where I want to be. If I'm learning how to play the piano, my first attempts are going to be disturbing. Nobody wants to listen to a beginner practice music. It's just noise. And if you say, well, I can't learn the guitar or the piano or whatever because all I'm making is noise, and instead of bringing pleasure to myself and others, I'm bringing displeasure to everybody. But you have to go through that step. There's, you know, unless you're Mozart, you can't jump to being a virtuoso in 2 minutes. Just doesn't work like that. And then we can say to Krishna, I mean, the great acharyas, they say, I've never done any devotional service. I've never actually done anything with devotion. Lord Chaitanya says, I don't have any love for Krishna. So we're never going to get to a point that we say, yes, I have transcended and I am pure now. And what I'm giving you is pure, you know, forget it. It's dynamic. Spiritual life is dynamic. We're always going to feel that our love can increase and our purity can increase. Anyway, give what you have. Don't worry about it. Really. Just say to Krishna, Krishna, I know this is really yucky and disgusting and it's dirty, but it's all I have. My daughter-in-law's father, I'll end with this, he told the story that one of his sons, when he was quite young, 4 or 5, walks up to him and says, Daddy, Daddy, here's a stick. His father didn't want a stick. What did a stick for? And he said in that moment he understood. What am I giving Krishna? I'm giving him, you know, yucky, dirty things, but I don't have anything else. And he appreciates it just like we appreciate something from a child. You know, the little baby, they're eating something and they'll take the food out of their mouth covered with their slobber and they'll hand it to you as a gift. That's what they have. And you don't hate the child. You're not like, you foolish 10-month-old baby handing me slobber-covered broccoli. You know, you accept that it's something out of love. You know, we just, there was some workmen over at my granddaughter's house yesterday, and her two-year-old was watching them, and he was sitting on the kitchen table with a bunch of his toys, and one of the workmen holds out his hand, and so the two-year-old gives the workman a toy car, and the workman takes the toy car and goes to put it in his pocket. He says, no, don't worry, I'll give it back to you. You know, he doesn't want a toy car. But it was an exchange of love anyway. And even though the workman knew that the little child was not really giving the toy car, it was really sweet. It was really heart-melting. And so Krishna's so kind, you know. We give him a leaf. We give him a little water. We just give him a little flower. We pick up a worm from the side of the road, you know, and he's happy. He's like, oh, thank you. Offer him a little food, give a little prasadam to somebody. Just be kind to somebody and say, Krishna, I'm kind to this person to please you. And even if our mind is going, well, you're not really trying to please me, it's all right, be quiet. Krishna, whatever, I'm trying to please you. Even if it's one iota of that in a sea of ego. And gradually the proportion changes. Gradually our desire to please Krishna overrides that ego as we act on it. I do have to go. Thank you very much. I'm not going to stay for the next kirtan. Srila Prabhupada ki.